Chapter 17. Galapagos Archipelago. Plate 79. Testudo Abingdonii, Galapagos Islands. Chapter Index. The whole group volcanic. Number of craters. Leafless bushes. Colony at Charles Island. James Island. Salt Lake and Crater. Natural history of the group. Ornithology, curious finches. Reptiles. Great tortoises, habits of. Marine lizard, feeds on seaweed. Terrestrial lizard, burrowing habits, herbivorous. Importance of reptiles in the archipelago. Fish, shells, insects. Botany. American type of organization. Differences in the species or races on different islands. Tameness of the birds. Fear of men and acquired instinct. September 15, 1835. Plate 80. Galapagos Archipelago. This archipelago consists of 10 principal islands, of which 5 exceed the others in size. They are situated under the equator, and between 5 and 600 miles westward of the coast of America. They are all formed of volcanic rocks, a few fragments of granite curiously glazed and altered by the heat can hardly be considered as an exception. Some of the craters surmounting the larger islands are of immense size, and they rise to a height of between 3 and 4,000 feet. Their flanks are studded by innumerable smaller orifices. I scarcely hesitate to affirm that there must be in the whole archipelago at least 2,000 craters. These consist either of lava and scoriae, or of finely stratified, sandstone-like tuff. Most of the latter are beautifully symmetrical. They owe their origin to eruptions of volcanic mud, without any lava. It is a remarkable circumstance that every one of the 28 tuff craters which were examined had their southern sides, either much lower than the other sides, or quite broken down and removed. As all these craters apparently have been formed when standing in the sea, and as the waves from the trade wind and the swell from the open Pacific here unite their forces on the southern coasts of all the islands, the singular uniformity in the broken state of the craters, composed of the soft and yielding tuff, is easily explained. Considering that these islands are placed directly under the equator, the climate is far from being excessively hot. The seam is chiefly caused by the singularly low temperature of the surrounding water, brought here by the great southern polar current. Excepting during one short season, very little rain falls, and even then it is irregular, but the clouds generally hang low. Hence, whilst the lower parts of the islands are very sterile, the upper parts, at a height of 1,000 feet and upwards, possess a damp climate and a tolerably luxuriant vegetation. This is especially the case on the windward sides of the islands, which first receive and condense the moisture from the atmosphere. In the morning, 17th, we landed on Chatham Island, which, like the others, rises with a tame and rounded outline, broken here and there by scattered hillocks, the remains of former craters. Nothing could be less inviting than the first appearance. A broken field of black basaltic lava, thrown into the most rugged waves and crossed by great fissures, is everywhere covered by stunted, sunburned brushwood, which shows little signs of life. The dry and parched surface, being heated by the noonday sun, gave to the air a close and sultry feeling, like that from a stove. We fancied even that the bushes smelt unpleasantly. Although I diligently tried to collect as many plants as possible, I succeeded in getting very few, and such wretched-looking little weeds would have better become an Arctic than an equatorial flora. The brushwood appears, from a short distance, as leafless as our trees during winter, and it was some time before I discovered that not only almost every plant was now in full leaf, but that the greater number were in flower. The commonest bushes, one of the Euphorbiaceae, an acacia, and a great odd-looking cactus are the only trees which afford any shade. After the season of heavy rains, the islands are said to appear for a short time partially green. The volcanic island of Fernando Noronha, placed in many respects under nearly similar conditions, is the only other country where I have seen a vegetation at all like this of the Galapagos Islands. The Beagle sailed round Chatham Island and anchored in several bays. One night I slept on shore, on a part of the island where black truncated cones were extraordinarily numerous. From one small eminence I counted 60 of them, all surmounted by craters more or less perfect. The greater number consisted merely of a ring of red scoriae, or slags, cemented together, and their height, above the plain of lava, was not more than from 50 to 100 feet. None had been very lately active. The entire surface of this part of the island seems to have been permeated, like a sieve, by the subterranean vapors. Here and there the lava, whilst soft, has been blown into great bubbles, and in other parts, the tops of caverns similarly formed have fallen in, leaving circular pits with steep sides. From the regular form of the many craters, they gave to the country an artificial appearance, which vividly reminded me of those parts of Staffordshire where the great iron foundries are most numerous. The day was glowing hot, and the scrambling over the rough surface and through the intricate thickets was very fatiguing, but I was well repaid by the strange cyclopean scene. As I was walking along, I met two large tortoises, each of which must have weighed at least 200 pounds. One was eating a piece of cactus, and, as I approached, it stared at me and slowly walked away. The other gave a deep hiss and drew in its head. These huge reptiles, surrounded by the black lava, the leafless shrubs, and large cacti, seemed to my fancy like some antediluvian animals. The few dull-colored birds cared no more for me than they did for the great tortoises. September 23, 1835. The Beagle proceeded to Charles Island. This archipelago has long been frequented, first by the buccaneers and latterly by whalers, but it is only within the last 6 years that a small colony has been established here. The inhabitants are between 200 and 300 in number. They are nearly all people of color, who have been banished for political crimes from the Republic of the Equator, of which Quito is the capital. The settlement is placed about 4.5 miles inland, and at a height probably of 1,000 feet. In the first part of the road we passed through leafless thickets, as in Chatham Island. Higher up the woods gradually became greener, and as soon as we crossed the ridge of the island we were cooled by a fine southerly breeze, and our sight refreshed by a green and thriving vegetation. In this upper region, coarse grasses and ferns abound, but there are no tree ferns. I saw nowhere any member of the palm family, which is the more singular, as 360 miles northward, Cocos Island takes its name from the number of cocoa nuts. The houses are irregularly scattered over a flat space of ground, which is cultivated with sweet potatoes and bananas. It will not easily be imagined how pleasant the sight of black mud was to us, after having been so long accustomed to the parched soil of Peru and northern Chile. The inhabitants, although complaining of poverty, obtain, without much trouble, the means of subsistence. In the woods there are many wild pigs and goats, but the staple article of animal food is supplied by the tortoises. Their numbers have of course been greatly reduced in this island, but the people yet count on 2 days' hunting giving them food for the rest of the week. It is said that formerly single vessels have taken away as many as 700, and that the ship's company of a frigate, some years since, brought down in one day 200 tortoises to the beach. September 29, 1835. We doubled the southwest extremity of Albemarle Island, and the next day were nearly becalmed between it and Narborough Island. Both are covered with immense deluges of black naked lava, which have flowed either over the rims of the great cauldrons, like pitch over the rim of a pot in which it has been boiled, or have burst forth from smaller orifices on the flanks. In their descent they have spread over miles of the sea coast. On both of these islands eruptions are known to have taken place, and in Albemarle we saw a small jet of smoke curling from the summit of one of the great craters. In the evening we anchored in Banks Cove, in Albemarle Island, The next morning I went out walking. To the south of the Broken Tuff crater, in which the Beagle was anchored, there was another beautifully symmetrical one of an elliptic form. Its longer axis was a little less than a mile, and its depth about 500 feet. At its bottom there was a shallow lake, in the middle of which a tiny crater formed an islet. The day was overpoweringly hot, and the lake looked clear and blue. I hurried down the cindery slope, and, choked with dust, eagerly tasted the water, but, to my sorrow, I found it salt as brine. The rocks on the coast abounded with great black lizards, between 3 and 4 feet long, and on the hills, an ugly yellowish-brown species was equally common. We saw many of this latter kind, some clumsily running out of the way, and others shuffling into their burrows. I shall presently describe in more detail the habits of both these reptiles. The whole of this northern part of Albemarle Island is miserably sterile. October 8, 1835. We arrived at James Island. This island, as well as Charles Island, were long since thus named after our kings of the Stuart line. Mr. Vino, myself, and our servants were left here for a week, with provisions, and a tent, whilst the Beagle went for water. We found here a party of Spaniards who had been sent from Charles Island, to dry fish, and to salt tortoise meat. About 6 miles inland, and at the height of nearly 2,000 feet, a hovel had been built in which 2 men lived who were employed in catching tortoises, whilst the others were fishing on the coast. I paid this party 2 visits, and slept there 1 night. As in the other islands, the lower region was covered by nearly leafless bushes, but the trees were here of a larger growth than elsewhere, several being 2 feet, and some even 2 feet 9 inches in diameter. The upper region, being kept damp by the clouds, supports a green and flourishing vegetation. So damp was the ground, that there were large beds of a coarse cypress, in which great numbers of a very small water ale lived and bred. While staying in this upper region, we lived entirely upon tortoise meat, the breastplate roasted, as the gauchos do carne con cuero, with the flesh on it, is very good, and the young tortoises make excellent soup, but otherwise the meat to my taste is indifferent. One day we accompanied a party of the Spaniards in their whale boat to a salina, or lake, from which salt is procured. After landing we had a very rough walk over a rugged field of recent lava, which has almost surrounded a tuff crater, at the bottom of which the salt lake lies. The water is only 3 or 4 inches deep, and rests on a layer of beautifully crystallized, white salt. The lake is quite circular, and is fringed with a border of bright green succulent plants. The almost precipitous walls of the crater are clothed with wood, so that the scene was altogether both picturesque and curious. A few years since the sailors belonging to a sealing vessel murdered their captain, in this quiet spot, and we saw his skull lying among the bushes. During the greater part of our stay of a week the sky was cloudless, and if the trade wind failed for an hour the heat became very oppressive. On 2 days the thermometer within the tent stood for some hours at 93 degrees, but in the open air, in the wind and sun, at only 85 degrees. The sand was extremely hot, the thermometer placed in some of a brown color immediately rose to 137 degrees, and how much above that it would have risen I do not know, for it was not graduated any higher. The black sand felt much hotter, so that even in thick boots it was quite disagreeable to walk over it. The natural history of these islands is eminently curious, and well deserves attention. Most of the organic productions are aboriginal creations found nowhere else. There is even a difference between the inhabitants of the different islands, yet all show a marked relationship with those of America, though separated from that continent by an open space of ocean, between 500 and 600 miles in width. The archipelago is a little world within itself, or rather a satellite attached to America, whence it has derived a few stray colonists, and has received the general character of its indigenous productions. Considering the small size of these islands, we feel the more astonished at the number of their aboriginal beings and at their confined range. Seeing every height crowned with its crater, and the boundaries of most of the lava streams still distinct, we are led to believe that within a period geologically recent, the unbroken ocean was here spread out. Hence, both in space and time, we seem to be brought somewhat near to that great fact, that mystery of mysteries, the first appearance of new beings on this earth. Of terrestrial mammals there is only one which must be considered as indigenous, namely a mouse, Musculophaginensis, and this is confined, as far as I could ascertain, to Chatham Island, the most easterly island of the group. It belongs, as I am informed by Mr. Waterhouse, to a division of the family of mice characteristic of America. At James Island there is a rat sufficiently distinct from the common kind to have been named and described by Mr. Waterhouse, but, as it belongs to the Old World division of the family, and, as this island has been frequented by ships for the last 150 years, I can hardly doubt that this rat is merely a variety produced by the new and peculiar climate, food, and soil to which it has been subjected. Although no one has a right to speculate without distinct facts, yet even with respect to the Chatham Island mouse, it should be borne in mind that it may possibly be an American species imported here, for I have seen, in the most unfrequented part of the Pampas, a native mouse living in the roof of a newly built hovel, and therefore its transportation in a vessel is not improbable. Analogous facts have been observed by Dr. Richardson in North America. Of land birds, I obtained 26 kinds, all peculiar to the group, and found nowhere else, with the exception of one lark-like finch from North America, Dolichonia recurvatus, which ranges on that continent as far north as 54 degrees and generally frequents marshes. The other 25 birds consist, firstly, of a hawk, curiously intermediate in structure between a buzzard and the American group of carrion-feeding polybori, and with these latter birds it agrees most closely in every habit and even tone of voice. Secondly, there are two owls, representing the short-eared and white barn owls of Europe. Thirdly, a wren, three tyrant flycatchers, two of them species of Pyrrhosae falla, one or both of which would be ranked by some ornithologists as only varieties, and that of all analogous to, but distinct from, American species. Fourthly, a swallow, which though differing from the Pronaperpurea of both Americas, only in being rather duller colored, smaller, and slenderer, is considered by Mr. Gould as specifically distinct. Fifthly, there are three species of mucking thrush, a form highly characteristic of America. The remaining land birds form a most singular group of finches, related to each other in the structure of their beaks, short tails, form of body, and plumage. There are 13 species which Mr. Gould has divided into 4 subgroups. All these species are peculiar to this archipelago, and so is the whole group, with the exception of one species of the subgroup Gocturnes, lately brought from Bow Island, in the Low Archipelago. Of Gocturnes, the two species may be often seen climbing about the flowers of the great cactus trees, but all the other species of this group of finches, mingled together in flocks, feed on the dry and sterile ground of the lower districts. The males of all, or certainly of the greater number, are jet black, and the females, with perhaps one or two exceptions, are brown. Plate 81. Finches from Galapagos Archipelago. 1. Geospiza magna rostris. 2. Geospiza furtus. 3. Geospiza parvula. 4. Cirthidae olivacea. The most curious fact is the perfect gradation in the size of the beaks in the different species of Geospiza, from one as large as that of a hawfinch to that of a chaffinch, and, if Mr. Gould is right in including his subgroup, Cercidia, in the main group, even to that of a warbler. The largest beak in the genus Geospiza is shown in Plate 81 Figure 1, and the smallest in Figure 3, but instead of there being only one intermediate species, with a beak of the size shown in Figure 2. There are no less than 6 species with insensibly graduated beaks. The beak of the subgroup Cercidea is shown in Figure 4. The beak of Gocdornis is somewhat like that of a starling, and that of the fourth subgroup, Camarahinchus, is slightly parrot-shaped. Seeing this gradation and diversity of structure in one small, intimately related group of birds, one might really fancy that from an original paucity of birds in this archipelago, one species had been taken and modified for different ends. In like manner, it might be fancied that a bird, originally a buzzard, had been induced here to undertake the office of the carrion feeding polybori of the American continent. Of waders and water birds, I was able to get only 11 kinds, and of these, only 3, including a rail confined to the damp summits of the islands, are new species. Considering the wandering habits of the gulls, I was surprised to find that the species inhabiting these islands is peculiar, but allied to one from the southern parts of South America. The far greater peculiarity of the land birds, namely, 25 out of 26 being new species, or at least new races, compared with the waders and web-footed birds, is in accordance with the greater range which these latter orders have in all parts of the world. We shall hereafter see this law of aquatic forms, whether marine or freshwater, being less peculiar at any given point of the Earth's surface, and the terrestrial forms of the same classes, strikingly illustrated in the shells, and in a lesser degree, in the insects of this archipelago. 2 of the waders are rather smaller than the same species brought from other places. The swallow is also smaller, though it is doubtful whether or not it is distinct from its analog. The 2 owls, the 2 tyrant flycatchers, Pyrrhosae phalla, and the dove, are also smaller than the analogous but distinct species, to which they are most nearly related. On the other hand, the gull is rather larger. The 2 owls, the swallow, all 3 species, of mucking thrush, the dove in its separate colors, though not in its whole plumage, the totanus, and the gull, are likewise duskier colored than their analogous species, and in the case of the mucking thrush and totanus, and any other species of the 2 genera, with the exception of a wren with a fine yellow breast, and of a tyrant flycatcher with a scarlet duff and breast, none of the birds are brilliantly colored, as might have been expected in an equatorial district. Hence it would appear probable that the same causes which here make the immigrants of some species smaller, make most of the peculiar Galapagian species also smaller, as well as very generally more dusky colored. All the plants have a wretched, weedy appearance, and I did not see one beautiful flower. The insects, again, are small-sized and dull-colored, and, as Mr. Waterhouse informs me, there is nothing in their general appearance which would have led him to imagine that they had come from under the equator. 17/1. The progress of research has shown that some of these birds, which were then thought to be confined to the islands, occur on the American continent. The eminent ornithologist, Mr. Sclater, informs me that this is the case with the Strix punctatissima and Pyrrhosae phalaenonis, and probably with the Otis galapagoensis and Zenata galapagoensis, so that the number of endemic birds is reduced to 23, or probably to 21. Mr. Sclater thinks that one or two of these endemic forms should be ranked rather as varieties than species, which always seemed to me probable. The birds, plants, and insects have a desert character, and are not more brilliantly colored than those from southern Patagonia. We may, therefore, conclude that the usual gaudy coloring of the intertropical productions is not related either to the heat or light of those zones, but to some other cause, perhaps to the conditions of existence being generally favorable to life. We will now turn to the order of reptiles, which gives the most striking character to the zoology of these islands. The species are not numerous, but the numbers of individuals of each species are extraordinarily great. There is one small lizard belonging to a South American genus, and 2 species, and probably more, of the Amblyrhynchus, a genus confined to the Galapagos Islands. There is one snake which is numerous, it is identical, as I am informed by M. de Brun, with the Samophis emigi from Chile. 17/2. This is stated by Dr. Gunther, Zoological Society, January 24, 1859, to be a peculiar species, not known to inhabit any other country. Of sea turtle I believe there are more than one species, and of tortoises there are, as we shall presently show, two or three species or races. Of toads and frogs there are none. I was surprised at this, considering how well suited for them the temperate and damp upper woods appeared to be. It recalled to my mind the remark made by Bory St. Vincent, namely, that none of this family are found on any of the volcanic islands in the great oceans. 17/3. Voyage aux Quatre Isles Africaines. With respect to the Sandwich Islands, see Tyerman and Bennett's Journal, Volume 1, page 434. For Mauritius, see Voyage par un officier, etc. Part 1, page 170. There are no frogs in the Canary Islands. Web, et Berthelot Hist. Nat. Des Isles Canaries. I saw none at St. Jago, in the Cape d'Verds. There are none at St. Helena. As far as I can ascertain from various works, this seems to hold good throughout the Pacific, and even in the large islands of the Sandwich Archipelago. Mauritius offers an apparent exception, where I saw the Rhinomys cariensis in abundance. This frog is said now to inhabit the Seychelles, Madagascar, and Bourbon, but on the other hand, Du Bois, in his voyage, in 1669, states that there were no reptiles in Bourbon except tortoises, and the officier du Roy asserts that before 1768 it had been attempted, without success, to introduce frogs into Mauritius, I presume for the purpose of eating. Hence it may be well doubted whether this frog is an aboriginal of these islands. The absence of the frog family in the oceanic islands is the more remarkable when contrasted with the case of lizards, which swarm on most of the smallest islands. May this difference not be caused by the greater facility with which the eggs of lizards, protected by calcareous shells, might be transported through salt water, than could the slimy spawn of frogs? I will first describe the habits of the tortoise, Testudo nigra, formerly called Indicot, which has been so frequently alluded to. These animals are found, I believe, on all the islands of the archipelago, certainly on the greater number. They frequent in preference the high damp parts, but they likewise live in the lower and arid districts. I have already shown, from the numbers which have been caught in a single day, how very numerous they must be. Some grow to animate size. Mr. Lawson, an Englishman, and vice-governor of the colony, told us that he had seen several so large that it required 6 or 8 men to lift them from the ground, and that some had afforded as much as 200 pounds of meat. The old males are the largest, the females rarely growing to so great a size. The male can readily be distinguished from the female by the greater length of its tail. The tortoises which live on those islands, where there is no water, or in the lower and arid parts of the others, feed chiefly on the succulent cactus. Those which frequent the higher and damp regions eat the leaves of various trees, a kind of berry, called quaeavida, which is acid and austere, and likewise a pale green filamentous lichen, Persinae replicata, that hangs from the boughs of the trees. The tortoise is very fond of water, drinking large quantities, and wallowing in the mud. The larger islands alone possess springs, and these are always situated towards the central parts, and at a considerable height. The tortoises, therefore, which frequent the lower districts, when thirsty, are obliged to travel from a long distance. Hence broad and well-beaten paths branch off in every direction from the wells down to the seacoast, and the Spaniards, by following them up, first discovered the watering places. When I landed at Chatham Island, I could not imagine what animal traveled so methodically along well-chosen tracks. Near the springs it was a curious spectacle, to behold many of these huge creatures, one set eagerly traveling onwards with outstretched necks, and another set returning, after having drunk their fill. When the tortoise arrives at the spring, quite regardless of any spectator, he buries his head in the water, above his eyes, and greedily swallows great mouthfuls at the rate of about 10 in a minute. The inhabitants say each animal stays 3 or 4 days in the neighborhood of the water, and then returns to the lower country, but they differed respecting the frequency of these visits. The animal probably regulates them according to the nature of the food on which it has lived. It is, however, certain that tortoises can subsist even on those islands, where there is no other water than what falls during a few rainy days in the year. I believe it is well ascertained that the bladder of the frog acts as a reservoir for the moisture necessary to its existence. Such seems to be the case with the tortoise. For some time after a visit to the springs, their urinary bladders are distended with fluid, which is said gradually to decrease in volume and to become less pure. The inhabitants, when walking in a lower district and overcome with thirst, often take advantage of this circumstance and drink the contents of the bladder, if full. In one I saw killed, the fluid was quite limpid and had only a very slightly bitter taste. The inhabitants, however, always first drink the water in the pericardium, which is described as being best. The tortoises, when purposely moving towards any point, travel by night and day, and arrive at their journey's end much sooner than would be expected. The inhabitants, from observing marked individuals, consider that they travel a distance of about 8 miles in 2 or 3 days. One large tortoise, which I watched, walked at the rate of 60 yards in 10 minutes, that is 360 yards, in the hour, or 4 miles a day, allowing a little time for it to eat on the road. During the breeding season, when the male and female are together, the male utters a hoarse roar, or bellowing, which, it is said, can be heard at the distance of more than 100 yards. The female never uses her voice, and the male only at these times, so that when the people hear this noise, they know that the two are together. They were at this time, October, laying their eggs. The female, where the soil is sandy, deposits them together, and covers them up with sand, but where the ground is rocky she drops them indiscriminately in any hole. Mr. Bino found 7 placed in a fissure. The egg is white and spherical, one which I measured was 7 inches 3/8 in circumference, and therefore larger than a hen's egg. The young tortoises, as soon as they are hatched, fall a prey in great numbers to the carrion feeding buzzard. The old ones seem generally to die from accidents, as from falling down precipices. At least, several of the inhabitants told me that they never found one dead without some evident cause. The inhabitants believe that these animals are absolutely deaf. Certainly they do not overhear a person walking close behind them. I was always amused when overtaking one of these great monsters, as it was quietly pacing along, to see how suddenly, the instant I passed, it would draw in its head and legs, and uttering a deep hiss fall to the ground with a heavy sound, as if struck dead. I frequently got on their backs, and then giving a few raps on the hinder part of their shells, they would rise up and walk away, but I found it very difficult to keep my balance. The flesh of this animal is largely employed, both fresh and salted, and a beautifully clear oil is prepared from the fat. When a tortoise is caught, the man makes a slit in the skin near its tail, so as to see inside its body whether the fat under the dorsal plate is thick. If it is not, the animal is liberated, and it is said to recover soon from this strange operation. In order to secure the tortoises, it is not sufficient to turn them, like turtle, for they are often able to get on their legs again. There can be little doubt that this tortoise is an aboriginal inhabitant of the Galapagos, for it is found on all, or nearly all, the islands, even on some of the smaller ones, where there is no water. Had it been an imported species, this would hardly have been the case in a group which has been so little frequented. Moreover, the old buccaneers found this tortoise in greater numbers even than at present. Wood and Rogers also, in 1708, say that it is the opinion of the Spaniards that it is found nowhere else in this quarter of the world. It is now widely distributed, but it may be questioned whether it is in any other place an aboriginal. The bones of a tortoise at Mauritius, associated with those of the extinct dodo, have generally been considered as belonging to this tortoise. If this had been so, undoubtedly it must have been there indigenous, but M. Debron informs me that he believes that it was distinct, as the species now living there certainly is. Plate 82. Amblyrhynchus cristatus. 8 tooth of natural size, and likewise magnified. The Amblyrhynchus, a remarkable genus of lizards, is confined to this archipelago. There are two species, resembling each other in general form, one being terrestrial, and the other aquatic. This latter species, A. cristatus, was first characterized by Mr. Bell, who well foresaw, from its short, broad head, and strong claws of equal length, that its habits of life would turn out very peculiar and different from those of its nearest ally, the iguana. It is extremely common on all the islands throughout the group, and lives exclusively on the rocky sea beaches, being never found, at least I never saw one, even 10 yards inshore. It is a hideous-looking creature, of a dirty black color, stupid and sluggish in its movements. The usual length of a full-grown one is about a yard, but there are some even 4 feet long. A large one weighed 20 pounds. On the island of Albemarle they seem to grow to a greater size than elsewhere. Their tails are flattened sideways, and all 4 feet partially webbed. They are occasionally seen some 100 yards from the shore, swimming about, and Captain Colnett, in his voyage, says, they go to sea, in herds of fishing, and sun themselves on the rocks, and may be called alligators in miniature. It must not, however, be supposed that they live on fish. When in the water this lizard swims with perfect ease and quickness, by a serpentine movement of its body and flattened tail, the legs being motionless and closely collapsed on its sides. A seaman on board sank one, with a heavy weight attached to it, thinking thus to kill it directly, but when, an hour afterwards, he drew up the line, it was quite active. Their limbs and strong claws are admirably adapted for crawling over the rugged and fissured masses of lava which everywhere form the coast. In such situations a group of 6 or 7 of these hideous reptiles may oftentimes be seen on the black rocks, a few feet above the surf, basking in the sun with outstretched legs. I opened the stomachs of several, and found them largely distended with mint seaweed, ave, which grows in thin foliaceous expansions of a bright green, or a dull red color. I do not recollect having observed this seaweed in any quantity on the tidal rocks, and I have reason to believe it grows at the bottom of the sea, at some little distance from the coast. If such be the case, the object of these animals occasionally going out to sea is explained. The stomach contained nothing but the seaweed. Mr. Bino, however, found a piece of a crab in one, but this might have gotten accidentally, in the same manner as I have seen a caterpillar in the midst of some lichen, in the paunch of a tortoise. The intestines were large, as in other herbivorous animals. The nature of this lizard's food, as well as the structure of its tail and feet, and the fact of its having been seen voluntarily swimming out at sea, absolutely prove its aquatic habits, yet there is in this respect one strange anomaly, namely, that when frightened it will not enter the water. Hence it is easy to drive these lizards down to any little point overhanging the sea, where they will sooner allow a person to catch hold of their tails, and jump into the water. They do not seem to have any notion of biting, but when much frightened they squirt a drop of fluid from each nostril. I threw one several times as far as I could into a deep pool left by the retiring tide, but it invariably returned in a direct line to the spot where I stood. It swam near the bottom, with a very graceful and rapid movement, and occasionally aided itself over the uneven ground with its feet. As soon as it arrived near the edge, but still being under water, it tried to conceal itself in the tufts of seaweed, or it entered some crevice. As soon As it thought the danger was past, it crawled out on the dry rocks and shuffled away as quickly as it could. I several times caught the same lizard by driving it down to a point, and though possessed of such perfect powers of diving and swimming, nothing would induce it to enter the water, and as often as I threw it in, it returned in the manner above described. Perhaps this singular piece of apparent stupidity may be accounted for by the circumstance that this reptile has no enemy whatever on shore, whereas at sea, it must often fall a prey to the numerous sharks. Hence, probably, urged by a fixed and hereditary instinct that the shore is its place of safety, whatever the emergency may be, it there takes refuge. During our visit in October, I saw extremely few small individuals of this species, and none I should think under a year old. From this circumstance it seems probable that the breeding season had not then commenced. I asked several of the inhabitants if they knew where it laid its eggs. They said that they knew nothing of its propagation, although well acquainted with the eggs of the land kind, a fact, considering how very common this lizard is, not a little extraordinary. We will now turn to the terrestrial species, Ada marlii, with a round tail and toes without webs. This lizard, instead of being found like the other on all the islands, is confined to the central part of the archipelago, namely to Albemarle, James, Barrington, and Indefatigable Islands. To the southward, in Charles, Hood, and Chatham Islands, and to the northward, in Towers, Bindlows, and Abingdon, I neither saw nor heard of any. It would appear as if it had been created in the center of the archipelago, and thence had been dispersed only to a certain distance. Some of these lizards inhabit the high and damp parts of the islands, but they are much more numerous in the lower and sterile districts near the coast. I cannot give a more forcible proof of their numbers than by stating that when we were left at James Island, we could not for some time find a spot free from their burrows on which to pitch our single tent. Like their brothers the sea kind, they are ugly animals, of a yellowish-orange beneath, and of a brownish red color above. From their low facial angle they have a singularly stupid appearance. They are, perhaps, of rather less size than the marine species, but several of them weighed between 10 and 15 pounds. In their movements they are lazy and half-torpid. When not frightened, they slowly crawl along with their tails and bellies dragging on the ground. They often stop and doze for a minute or two, with closed eyes and hind legs spread out on the parched soil. They inhabit burrows which they sometimes make between fragments of lava, but more generally on level patches of the soft sandstone like duff. The holes do not appear to be very deep, and they enter the ground at a small angle, so that when walking over these lizard warrens, the soil is constantly giving way, much to the annoyance of the tired walker. This animal, when making its burrow, works alternately the opposite sides of its body. One front leg for a short time scratches up the soil, and throws it towards the hind foot, which is well placed so as to heave it beyond the mouth of the hole. That side of the body being tired, the other takes up the task, and so on alternately. I watched one for a long time, till half its body was buried. I then walked up and pulled it by the tail. At this it was greatly astonished, and soon shuffled up to see what was the matter, and then stared me in the face, as much as to say, "What made you pull my tail?" They feed by day, and do not wander far from their burrows. If frightened, they rush to them with a most awkward gait. Except when running downhill, they cannot move very fast, apparently from the lateral position of their legs. They are not at all timorous. When attentively watching anyone, they curl their tails, and, raising themselves on their front legs, nod their heads vertically, with a quick movement, and try to look very fierce, but in reality they are not at all so. If one just stamps on the ground, down go their tails, and off they shuffle as quickly as they can. I have frequently observed small fly-eating lizards, when watching anything, nod their heads in precisely the same manner, but I do not at all know for what purpose. If the Samlerhynchus is held and plagued with a stick, it will bite it very severely, but I caught many by the tail, and they never tried to bite me. If two are placed on the ground and held together, they will fight, and bite each other till blood is drawn. The individuals, and they are the greater number, which inhabit the lower country, can scarcely taste a drop of water throughout a year, but they consume much of the succulent cactus, the branches of which are occasionally broken off by the wind. I several times threw a piece to two, or three of them, when together, and it was amusing enough to see them trying to seize and carry it away in their mouths, like so many hungry dogs with a bone. They eat very deliberately, but do not chew their food. The little birds are aware how harmless these creatures are. I have seen one of the thick-billed finches picking at one end of a piece of cactus, which is much relished by all the animals of the lower region, whilst a lizard was eating at the other end, and afterwards the little bird with the utmost indifference hopped on the back of the reptile. I opened the stomachs of several, and found them full of vegetable fibers and leaves of different trees, especially of an acacia. In the upper region they live chiefly on the acid and astringent berries of the guayabita, under which trees I have seen these lizards and the huge tortoises feeding together. To obtain the acacia leaves they crawl up the low stunted trees, and it is not uncommon to see a pair quietly browsing, whilst seated on a branch several feet above the ground. These lizards, when cooked, yield a white meat, which is liked by those whose stomachs soar above all prejudices. Humboldt has remarked that in intertropical South America, all lizards which inhabit dry regions are esteemed delicacies for the table. The inhabitants state that those which inhabit the upper damp parts drink water, but that the others do not, like the tortoises, travel up for it from the lower sterile country. At the time of our visit, the females had within their bodies numerous, large, elongated eggs, which they lay in their burrows. The inhabitants seek them for food. These two species of Amlerhynchus agree, as I have already stated, in their general structure, and in many of their habits. Neither have that rapid movement, so characteristic of the general Acerta and Iguana. They are both herbivorous, although the kind of vegetation on which they feed is so very different. Mr. Bell has given the name to the genus from the shortness of the snout. Indeed, the form of the mouth may almost be compared to that of the tortoise. One is led to suppose that this is an adaptation to their herbivorous appetites. It is very interesting thus to find a well-characterized genus, having its marine and terrestrial species, belonging to so confined a portion of the world. The aquatic species is by far the most remarkable, because it is the only existing lizard which lives on marine vegetable productions. As I at first observed, these islands are not so remarkable for the number of the species of reptiles, as for that of the individuals, when we remember the well-beaten paths made by the thousands of huge tortoises, the many turtles, the great herons of the terrestrial Amlerhynchus, and the groups of the marine species basking on the coast rocks of every island, we must admit that there is no other quarter of the world where this order replaces the herbivorous mammalia in so extraordinary a manner. The geologist on hearing this will probably refer back in his mind to the secondary epochs, when lizards, some herbivorous, some carnivorous, and of dimensions comparable only with our existing whales, swarmed on the land and in the sea. It is, therefore, worthy of his observation that this archipelago, instead of possessing a humid climate and rank vegetation, cannot be considered otherwise than extremely arid and, for an equatorial region, remarkably temperate. To finish with the zoology, the 15 kinds of sea fish which I procured here are all new species. They belong to 12 genera, all widely distributed, with the exception of Prionotus, of which the four previously known species live on the eastern side of America. Of land shells I collected 16 kinds, and two marked varieties, of which, with the exception of one helix found at Tahiti, all are peculiar to this archipelago. A single freshwater shell, Paladina, is common to Tahiti and Van Diemen's Land. Mr. Cumming, before our voyage, procured here 90 species of seashells, and this does not include several species not yet specifically examined of Trochaeus, Turbo, Monodontoc, and Nasa. He has been kind enough to give me the following interesting results. Of the 90 shells, no less than 47 are unknown elsewhere, a wonderful fact, considering how widely distributed seashells generally are. Of the 43 shells found in other parts of the world, 25 inhabit the western coast of America, and of these 8 are distinguishable as varieties. The remaining 18, including one variety, were found by Mr. Cumming, in the Low Archipelago, and some of them also at the Philippines. This fact of shells from islands in the central parts of the Pacific occurring here deserves notice, for not one single seashell is known to be common to the islands of that ocean, and to the west coast of America. The space of open sea, running north and south off the west coast, separates to quite distinct conchological provinces, but at the Galapagos Archipelago we have a halting place, where many new forms have been created, and with these two great conchological provinces have each sent several colonists. The American province has also sent here representative species, for there is a Galapagian species of Monoceros, a genus only found on the west coast of America, and there are Galapagian species of Fissurella and Cancellaria, genera common on the west coast, but not found, as I am informed by Mr. Cumming, in the central islands of the Pacific. On the other hand, there are Galapagian species of Aniscia and Stilifer, genera common to the West Indies, and to the Chinese and Indian seas, but not found either on the west coast of America, or in the central Pacific. I may here add that after the comparison by Messrs. Cumming and Hines of about 2,000 shells from the eastern and western coasts of America, only one single shell was found in common, namely, the Purpura petula, which inhabits the West Indies, the coast of Panama, and the Galapagos. We have, therefore, in this quarter of the world, three great conchological sea provinces, quite distinct, though surprisingly near each other, being separated by long north and south spaces, either of land or of open sea. I took great pains in collecting the insects, but excepting Tierra del Fuego, I never saw in this respect so poor a country. Even in the upper and damp region I procured very few, excepting some Minidiptera and Hymenoptera, mostly of common mundane forms. As before remarked, the insects, for a tropical region, are of very small size, and dull colors. Of beetles I collected 25 species, excluding Adermestas and Quarinet, imported wherever a ship touches. Of these, 2 belong to the Harpalidae, 2 to the Hydrophilidae, 9 to 3 families of the Heteromera, and the remaining 12 to as many different families. This circumstance of insects, and I may add plants, where few in number, belonging to many different families, is, I believe, very general. Mr. Waterhouse, who has published an account of the insects of this archipelago, and to whom I am indebted for the above details, informs me that there are several new genera, and that of the genera not new, 1 or 2 are American, and the rest of mundane distribution. 17/4. Annals and Magazine of Natural History, Volume 16, page 19. With the exception of a wood-feeding apate, and of 1 or probably 2 water beetles, from the American continent, all the species appear to be new. The botany of this group is fully as interesting as the zoology. Dr. J. Hooker will soon publish in the Linnean Transactions a full account of the flora, and I am much indebted to him for the following details. Of flowering plants there are, as far as at present is known, 185 species, and 40 cryptogamic species, making together 225. Of this number I was fortunate enough to bring home 193. Of the flowering plants, 100 are new species, and are probably confined to this archipelago. Dr. Hooker conceives that, of the plants not so confined, at least 10 species found near the cultivated ground at Charles Island have been imported. It is, I think, surprising that more American species have not been introduced naturally, considering that the distance is only between 500 and 600 miles from the continent, and that, according to Colnett, page 58, driftwood, bamboos, canes, and the nuts of a palm are often washed on the southeastern shores. The proportion of 100 flowering plants out of 185, or 175 excluding the imported weeds, being new, is sufficient, I conceive, to make the Galapagos Archipelago a distinct botanical province, but this flora is not nearly so peculiar as that of St. Helena, nor, as I am informed by Dr. Hooker, of Juan Fernandez. The peculiarity of the Galapagian flora is best shown in certain families. Thus there are 21 species of Composita, of which 20 are peculiar to this archipelago. These belong to 12 genera, and of these genera no less than 10 are confined to the archipelago. Dr. Hooker informs me that the flora has an undoubted Western American character, nor can he detect in it any affinity with that of the Pacific. If, therefore, we accept the 18 marine, the 1 freshwater, and 1 land shell, which have apparently come here as colonists from the central islands of the Pacific, and likewise the 1 distinct Pacific species of the Galapagian group of finches, we see that this archipelago, though standing in the Pacific Ocean, is zoologically part of America. If this character were owing merely to immigrants from America, there would be little remarkable in it, but we see that a vast majority of all the land animals, and that more than half of the flowering plants, are aboriginal productions. It was most striking to be surrounded by new birds, new reptiles, new shells, new insects, new plants, and yet by innumerable trifling details of structure, and even by the tones of voice and plumage of the birds, to have the temperate plains of Patagonia, or the hot dry deserts of northern Chile, vividly brought before my eyes. Why, on these small points of land, which within a late geological period must have been covered by the ocean, which are formed of basaltic lava, and therefore differ in geological character from the American continent, and which are placed under a peculiar climate, why were their aboriginal inhabitants associated, I may add, in different proportions both in kind and number from those on the continent, and therefore acting on each other in a different manner? Why were they created on American types of organization? It is probable that the islands of the Cape d'Averde group resemble, in all their physical conditions, far more closely the Galapagos Islands, and these latter physically resemble the coast of America. Yet the aboriginal inhabitants of the two groups are totally unlike those of the Cape d'Averde Islands bearing the impress of Africa, as the inhabitants of the Galapagos Archipelago are stamped with that of America. I have not as yet noticed by far the most remarkable feature in the natural history of this archipelago. It is that the different islands to a considerable extent are inhabited by a different set of beings. My attention was first called to this fact by the vice-governor, Mr. Lawson, declaring that the tortoises differed from the different islands, and that he could with certainty tell from which island anyone was brought. I did not for some time pay sufficient attention to this statement, and I had already partially mingled together the collections from 2 of the islands. I never dreamed that islands, about 50 or 60 miles apart, and most of them in sight of each other, formed of precisely the same rocks, placed under a quite similar climate, rising to a nearly equal height, would have been differently tenanted, but we shall soon see that this is the case. It is the fate of most voyagers, no sooner to discover what is most interesting in any locality, and they are hurried from it, but I ought, perhaps, to be thankful that I obtained sufficient materials to establish this most remarkable fact in the distribution of organic beings. The inhabitants, as I have said, state that they can distinguish the tortoises from the different islands, and that they differ not only in size, but in other characters. Captain Porter has described those from Charles, and from the nearest island to it, namely, Hood Island, as having their shells in front thick, and turned up, like a Spanish saddle, whilst the tortoises from James Island are rounder, blacker, and have a better taste when cooked. 17/5. Voyage in the U.S. Ship Essex, Volume 1, page 215. M. Bibron, moreover, informs me that he has seen what he considers two distinct species of tortoise from the Galapagos, but he does not know from which islands. The specimens that I brought from three islands were young ones, and probably owing to this cause neither Mr. Gray nor myself could find in them any specific differences. I have remarked that the marine Amblerhynchus was larger at Albemarle Island than elsewhere, and M. Bibron informs me that he has seen two distinct aquatic species of this genus, so that the different islands probably have their representative species or races of the Amblerhynchus, as well as of the tortoise. My attention was first thoroughly aroused by comparing together the numerous specimens shot by myself and several other parties on board of the mocking thrushes, when, to my astonishment, I discovered that all those from Charles Island belonged to one species, Mimistrif ashatus, all from Albemarle Island to Imparvulus, and all from James and Chatham Islands, between which two other islands are situated, as connecting links, belong to M. Melanitis. These two latter species are closely allied, and would by some ornithologists be considered as only well-marked traces or varieties, but the Mimistrif ashatus is very distinct. Unfortunately, most of the specimens of the finch tribe were mingled together, but I have strong reasons to suspect that some of the species of the subgroup Jaspisa are confined to separate islands. If the different islands have their representatives of Jaspisa, it may help to explain the singularly large number of the species of this subgroup in this one small archipelago, and, as a probable consequence of their numbers, the perfectly graduated series in the size of their beaks. Two species of the subgroup Gocdornis and two of the Camarahynchus were procured in the archipelago, and of the numerous specimens of these two subgroups shot by four collectors at James Island, all were found to belong to one species of each, whereas the numerous specimens shot either on Chatham or Charles Island, for the two sets were mingled together, all belonged to the two other species. Hence we may feel almost sure that these islands possess their representative species of these two subgroups. In land shells this law of distribution does not appear to hold good. In my very small collection of insects, Mr. Waterhouse remarks that of those which were ticketed with their locality, not one was common to any two of the islands. Table 17/1. Column 1, name of island. Column 2, total number of species. Column 3, number of species found in other parts of the world. Column 4. Number of species confined to the Galapagos Archipelago. Column 5. Number confined to the one island. Column 6. Number of species confined to the Galapagos Archipelago, but found on more than the one island. James. 71. 33. 38. 30. 8. Albemarle. 46. 18. 26. 22. 4. Chatham. 32. 16. 16. 12. 4. Charles. 68. 39. Or 29, if the probably imported plants be subtracted. 29. 21. 8. If we now turn to the flora, we shall find the aboriginal plants of the different islands wonderfully different. I give all the preceding results, Table 17/1, on the high authority of my friend Dr. J. Hooker. I may premise that I indiscriminately collected everything in flower on the different islands, and fortunately kept my collection separate. Too much confidence, however, must not be placed in the proportional results, as the small collections brought home by some other naturalists, though in some respects confirming the results, plainly show that much remains to be done in the botany of this group. The Leguminaceae, moreover, have as yet been only approximately worked out. Hence we have the truly wonderful fact that in James Island, of the 38 Galapagian plants, or those found in no other part of the world, 30 are exclusively confined to this one island, and in Albemarle Island, of the 26 aboriginal Galapagian plants, 22 are confined to this one island, that is, only 4 are at present known to grow in the other islands of the archipelago, and so on. As shown in the above table, with the plants from Chatham and Charles Islands. This fact will, perhaps, be rendered even more striking by giving a few illustrations. Bus Scalesia, the remarkable arborescent genus of the Composita, is confined to the archipelago. It has 6 species, one from Chatham, one from Albemarle, one from Charles Island, 2 from James Island, and the 6th from one of the 3 latter islands, but it is not known from which. Not one of these 6 species grows on any 2 islands. Again, Euphorbia, a mundane or widely distributed genus, has here 8 species, of which 7 are confined to the archipelago, and not one found on any 2 islands. Acalypha and Braria, both mundane genera, have respectively 6 and 7 species, none of which have the same species on 2 islands, with the exception of one Braria, which does occur on 2 islands. The species of the Composita are particularly local, and Dr. Hooker has furnished me with several other most striking illustrations of the difference of the species on the different islands. He remarks that this law of distribution holds good both with those genera confined to the archipelago and those distributed in other quarters of the world. In like manner, we have seen that the different islands have their proper species of the mundane genus of tortoise, and of the widely distributed American genus of the mocking thrush, as well as of 2 of the Galapagian subgroups of finches, and almost certainly of the Galapagian genus Amblyrhynchus. The distribution of the tenants of this archipelago would not be nearly so wonderful if, for instance, one island had a mocking thrush, and a second island some other quite distinct genus, if one island had its genus of lizard, and a second island another distinct genus, or none whatever, or if the different islands were inhabited, not by representative species of the same genera of plants, but by totally different genera, as does to a certain extent hold good, for, to give one instance, a large berry-bearing tree at James Island has no representative species in Charles Island. But it is the circumstance that several of the islands possess their own species of the tortoise, mocking thrush, finches, and numerous plants, these species having the same general habits, occupying analogous situations, and obviously filling the same place in the natural economy of this archipelago, that strikes me with wonder. It may be suspected that some of these representative species, at least in the case of the tortoise, and of some of the birds, may hereafter prove to be only well-marked traces, but this would be of equally great interest to the philosophical naturalist. I have said that most of the islands are in sight of each other. I may specify that Charles Island is 50 miles from the nearest part of Chatham Island, and 33 miles from the nearest part of Albemarle Island. Chatham Island is 60 miles from the nearest part of James Island, but there are 2 intermediate islands between them which were not visited by me. James Island is only 10 miles from the nearest part of Albemarle Island, but the 2 points where the collections were made are 32 miles apart. I must repeat that neither the nature of the soil, nor height of the land, nor the climate, nor the general character of the associated beings, and therefore their action one on another, can differ much in the different islands. If there be any sensible difference in their climates, it must be between the windward group, namely, Charles and Chatham Islands, and that to leeward, but there seems to be no corresponding difference in the productions of these 2 halves of the archipelago. The only light which I can throw on this remarkable difference in the inhabitants of the different islands is that very strong currents of the sea, running in a westerly and west-northwesterly direction, must separate, as far as transportal by the sea is concerned, the southern islands from the northern ones, and between these northern islands a strong northwest current was observed, which must effectually separate James and Albemarle Islands. As the archipelago is free to a most remarkable degree from gales of wind, neither the birds, insects, nor lighter seeds would be blown from island to island. And lastly, the profound depth of the ocean between the islands, and their apparently recent, in a geological sense, volcanic origin, render it highly unlikely that they were ever united, and this, probably, is a far more important consideration than any other with respect to the geographical distribution of their inhabitants. Reviewing the facts here given, one is astonished at the amount of creative force, if such an expression may be used, displayed on these small, barren, and rocky islands, and still more so, at its diverse yet analogous action on points so near each other. I have said that the Galapagos Archipelago might be called a satellite attached to America, but it should rather be called a group of satellites, physically similar, organically distinct, yet intimately related to each other, and all related in a marked though much lesser degree to the great American continent. I will conclude my description of the natural history of these islands by giving an account of the extreme tameness of the birds. This disposition is common to all the terrestrial species, namely, to the mocking thrushes, the finches, wrens, tyrant flycatchers, the dove, and carrion buzzard. All of them often approached sufficiently near to be killed with a switch, and sometimes, as I myself tried, with a cap or hat. A gun is here almost superfluous, for with the muzzle I pushed a hawk off the branch of a tree. One day, whilst lying down, a mocking thrush alighted on the edge of a pitcher, made of the shell of a tortoise, which I held in my hand, and began very quietly to sip the water. It allowed me to lift it from the ground whilst seated on the vessel. I often tried, and very nearly succeeded, in catching these birds by their legs. Formerly the birds appear to have been even tamer, and at present, Cowley, in the year 1684, says that the turtle doves were so tame that they would often alight on our hats and arms, so as that we could take them alive, they not fearing man, until such time as some of our company did fire at them, whereby they were rendered more shy. Dampier also, in the same year, says that a man in a morning's walk might kill 6 or 7 dozen of these doves. At present, although certainly very tame, they do not alight on people's arms, nor do they suffer themselves to be killed in such large numbers. It is surprising that they have not become wilder, for these islands during the last 150 years have been frequently visited by buccaneers and whalers, and the sailors, wandering through the wood in search of tortoises, always take cruel delight in knocking down the little birds. These birds, although now still more persecuted, do not readily become wild. In Charles Island, which had then been colonized about 6 years, I saw a boy sitting by a well with a switch in his hand, with which he killed the doves and finches as they came to drink. He had already procured a little heap of them for his dinner, and he said that he had constantly been in the habit of waiting by this well for the same purpose. It would appear that the birds of this archipelago, not having as yet learned that man is a more dangerous animal, and the tortoise, or the ambler finches, disregard him, in the same manner as in England, shy birds, such as magpies, disregard the cows and horses grazing in our fields. The Falkland Islands offer a second instance of birds with a similar disposition. The extraordinary tameness of the little Lopetia rinchus has been remarked by Prunetti, Lesson, and other voyagers. It is not, however, peculiar to that bird. The polydorus, snipe, upland and lowland goose, thrush, bunting, and even some true hawks are all more or less tame. As the birds are so tame there, where foxes, hawks, and owls occur, we may infer that the absence of all rapacious animals at the Galapagos is not the cause of their tameness here. The upland geese at the Falklands show, by the precaution they take in building on the islets, that they are aware of their danger from the foxes, but they are not by this rendered wild towards man. The tameness of the birds, especially of the waterfowl, is strongly contrasted with the habits of the same species in Tierra del Fuego, where for ages past they have been persecuted by the wild inhabitants. In the Falklands, The sportsman may sometimes kill more of the upland geese in one day, and he can carry home, whereas in Tierra del Fuego it is nearly as difficult to kill one, as it is in England, to shoot the common wild goose. In the time of Pernetti, 1763, all the birds there appear to have been much tamer, and at present, he states that the Apetiorhynchus would almost perch on his finger, and that with the wand, he killed 10.5 hours. At that period the birds must have been about as tame as they now are at the Galapagos. They appear to have learned caution more slowly at these latter islands, and at the Falklands, where they have had proportionate means of experience. For besides frequent visits from vessels, those islands have been at intervals colonized during the entire period. Even formerly, when all the birds were so tame, it was impossible by Pernetti's account to kill the black-necked swan, a bird of passage, which probably brought with it the wisdom learnt in foreign countries. I may add that, according to Du Bois, all the birds at Bourbon, in 1571-72, with the exception of the flamingos and geese, were so extremely tame, that they could be caught by the hand, or killed in any number with a stick. Again, at Tristan Akinon in the Atlantic, Carmichael states that the only two land birds, a thrush and a bunting, were so tame as to suffer themselves to be caught with a hand net. 17/6. Linnean Transactions, Volume 12, page 496. The most anomalous fact on this subject which I have met with is the wildness of the small birds in the Arctic parts of North America, as described by Richardson Fonabore, Volume 2, page 332, where they are said never to be persecuted. This case is the more strange, because it is asserted that some of the same species in their winter quarters, in the United States, are tame. There is much, as Dr. Richardson well remarks, utterly inexplicable connected with the different degrees of shyness and care with which birds conceal their nests. How strange it is that the English wood pigeon, generally so wild a bird, should very frequently rear its young in shrubberies close to houses. From these several facts we may, I think, conclude, first, that the wildness of birds with regard to man is a particular instinct directed against him, and not dependent upon any general degree of caution arising from other sources of danger. Secondly, that it is not acquired by individual birds in a short time, even when much persecuted, but that in the course of successive generations it becomes hereditary. With domesticated animals, we are accustomed to see new mental habits or instincts acquired and rendered hereditary, but with animals, in a state of nature it must always be most difficult to discover instances of acquired hereditary knowledge. In regard to the wildness of birds towards man, there is no way of accounting for it, except as an inherited habit. Comparatively few young birds, in any one year, have been injured by man in England, yet almost all, even nestlings, are afraid of him. Many individuals, on the other hand, both at the Galapagos and at the Falklands, have been pursued and injured by man, but yet have not learned a salutary dread of him. We may infer from these facts what havoc the introduction of any new beast of prey must cause in a country, before the instincts of the indigenous inhabitants have become adapted to the stranger's craft or power. The end of Chapter 17.